Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley. And on this lovely fall day in 2025, our guest is Elizabeth Bass Parman. Elizabeth is a native Nashvillian who had the extraordinarily good fortune of having as an English teacher in middle school author Lee Smith. And Lee told Elizabeth to always keep writing, which she has joyfully done. She received her bachelor's degree in English literature from Hamilton College and spent a glorious junior year in Canterbury, England. And she, after working in Manhattan, returned to Nashville, married her high school sweetheart, and has two now grown identical twin daughters. She holds a master's degree in education and recently retired from a nonprofit working with children and adults with reading-based learning disabilities. The book that we're talking about today is Bees in June. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So this is not your first book?
No, it's my second.
It's your second. Okay, yeah. So when did you start writing novels?
Well, I started writing for myself as a child and have notebooks filled with scribbles and stories. But I had my version of a midlife crisis when I turned 40. And I thought, well, if I want to be a published novelist, I really do need to write a novel first. And so I decided I better get that done. So I'd always, of course, dreamed of being a writer. It's what I always wanted to do. But I thought, okay, you need to get serious about it. So I wrote my first novel and queried it. I didn't get anywhere with it, but the bug had bit me. And I started writing seriously when I turned 40. And I'm 64 now, so that was quite a while ago.
So when was your first published novel?
My first published novel came out in 2024, The Empress of Cook County. So I queried off and on for 24 years before I got an agent. And I will say I took some breaks, some long ones, some shorter ones, but I always was connected to the writing world and wanting to be published. So I always kept a hand in it, trying to get published, sometimes harder than other times because of working full time and raising my family. But I never let go of that dream. So it took me really buckling down 24 years to get published, which is taking the slow road, absolutely. But when it happened, it was glorious. I ended up with, when I got my agent and we went on submission, 2 weeks after she sent her query letters, we had a four-way auction. So it was worth the wait.
Wow, that is fantastic. So what was it about The Empress of Cook County? Is that the title? Yeah,
that's
The Empress
it.
Of Cook County. Yeah. That made that one the one that you broke through with. What was different about that from the novels you'd written earlier?
It had an interesting hook to it, and one that I hadn't seen anybody else do. And I think that was a big part of it. It's based on the Empress tarot card, with the idea of, if you know anything about tarot, if the Empress card is pulled from the deck upright where she's facing correctly, the card means all the good things in the world. But if you pull it from the deck upside down, it's all the bad things in the world. And so they're opposite meanings. And my mom and I were talking about our family history. She's a genealogist, and she is interested in the story in my family that we are descendants of Pocahontas. I don't know if that is true or not, but it would be awesome.
Have you done DNA testing to see if you have Native American DNA?
We do have some Native American blood, so it could be. It's possible. But Mom said to me, did you know that Pocahontas was known as the Empress of Virginia? And I thought, oh, well, that's a good title, because I'm always listening for good titles. And I thought, well, even though we're originally from Virginia, we're Tennesseans. And I thought, well, what about the Empress of Tennessee? And I thought, oh, we have 96 counties. It's too much. I can't do all that. And then I thought, what if there's a woman who wants to be the empress over one tiny little county in Tennessee. And that's where the idea came from. And it's a mother-daughter dual POV where the mother is the empress reversed. She's shallow and vain, self-centered, a bad person. But her daughter is the empress upright. And she's generous and kind and loving and all the good things. And those two were set up against each other with the dual POV. And I think it had an interesting hook to it. And I think that's what got people's attention. And I had some awesome blurbs behind it. Lee Smith wrote me a beautiful blurb. And Fannie Flagg wrote one for me.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
So that's
so how did you connect with her?
With Fannie Flagg?
Yeah, I know. I already know that Lee Smith was your middle school teacher, so you had a connection already. But with Fannie, how did you connect with her?
Well, my editor said to me, and this was after we got our book deal, my editor said to me, if you could have any blurb in the whole world, who would you want? She said, I want you to dream big. And I laughed and said, oh, I'm good at that. And I said, the answer is obviously Fannie Flagg. And she said, okay, we're going to write her a letter and ask for the blurb. And I said, when you say we, do you mean all the big dogs at HarperCollins, the higher ups? And she said, no, I mean you and me. And so she and I both wrote very heartfelt letters. And she said, yes, she was very gracious about it.
And she's the author of, is it Fried Green Tomatoes?
Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe. That's her most famous.
Yes. Wow. So how many novels do you have in your drawer?
Well, just that first one that will stay in my drawer. It was my training novel, I'll call it. I like the idea is good, and I may revisit it sometime, but the writing was not strong enough, and I understand why it got rejected. But I learned so much from that novel writing it and applied what I had learned to the next books. And actually, there's also a kind of a half novel in the drawer. I had written Bees in June as my second book, but I wrote it as a YA. And I had my main character, Rennie, in Bees in June. She's 23 years old. She's married and has adult challenges. The book that I initially wrote was also Bees in June, but she was 17 and she had high school challenges. And so I had written that book. So really that one might count as being in the drawer because the YA version is in there.
Okay.
But then when I got my book deal with the Empress of Cook County, part of the auction, it went from one book to two books. And I took Bees in June and rewrote it to be not a sequel, but be in the series of with the Empress of Cook County. So I did extensive a rewrite on it. So technically, I guess I have two in the drawer.
Okay. So you had worked on the Empress of Cook County for quite a while before you found your agent. So
yes,
and that must have been, so you said, you know, for 24 years, you didn't have that book. You were trying to find an agent with the first book for some period of time. And then you decided to start another one and do another one. And you really stuck with it. And now you succeeded.
I did. I stopped counting the rejections at 200. Because I thought, well, does it really matter 212 or 224? It does. After 200, I think you can just say it's been thoroughly, thoroughly rejected. But all of the, not all, the rejections where I got feedback, they were very complimentary and said, you know, good writing, love the story. But there was always a but, though. You know, my list is full. I'm not what I'm looking for, you know, all the standard reasons for rejection, which I understand, but I did get every kind of rejection known to any writer. I think I've seen a version of every rejection letter out there.
Wow. What kept you going?
Determination and stubbornness and honoring the dream I had when I was a little girl. I tell this story of myself. When I turned 4, my parents had a cocktail party. This was the 60s, all super glamorous. And my sisters and I had to come out at night, at bedtime, and say goodnight to the guests. My mom made us do that in our little Lands of Salzburg nightgowns. It was very Sound of Music, you know. And one of the guests at the party said to me, "I hear you turned 4," and I said, "Yes, sir." He goes, "So what did you pick?" And I looked at him and I was very confused. And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Your career. Everyone knows when you turn 4, you have to pick your career. What do you want to be when you grow up? What did you pick?" And I absolutely panicked. I had no idea and I couldn't give him an answer, but I was very upset. And so thought about it all
night.
What
a terrible thing to say to a kid.
I know, but he was 2 martinis in, I suspect.
Yeah.
But 4-year-old me did not know that. And I was also quite annoyed with my sister, who was 7 at the time, who had not mentioned this to me. I was caught unaware. And so the next day I go to my mom, who knows nothing of this conversation. And I said, "Mom, I have 2 questions." She's like, "Okay." I said, "Our princess is real." And she said, "Some are." I said, "Okay, good. Where do books come from?" And she said, "People write them. They're called authors." "Okay." I said, "So when I grow up, I'm going to be either a princess or an author." And that little, and she's like, "Okay, great." She didn't know until a couple of years ago that was the backstory to my pronouncement that I was going to be a writer when I turned 4. But that little 4-year-old me was right. I would love to be a princess. That didn't really work out. But although my husband might disagree. But it was just always just part of my soul. I just wanted that. But I also was in the work world and had to make money and pay rent and all those things, and then got married and raised my children. So it was sometimes or oftentimes on the back burner, but I could just never let that dream go. Never could. And so with each rejection, I just went, "Okay, there's one more. And now I'll send out 3 more queries."
Wow. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Elizabeth Bass Parman, author of Bees in June. Tell us about the story, what the story is in Bees in June, and where that concept came from.
I worked for many years in the nonprofit sector, working primarily with school-aged children. And one day we had a snow day and everything was canceled, which is fairly rare here in Nashville. I mean, it does happen. But I was enjoying my day off and not using my time wisely. I was scrolling social media. And a friend of mine who's a gardener had posted a very small newspaper clipping from the 1940s about a beekeeper in Massachusetts named John Zepka. And this is true. He passed away and his bees attended his funeral, all of them. They flew to the cemetery and were gathered around the gravesite. And then at the conclusion of the funeral, they went back to their hives. And the article was very, I know, and the article just said he was known to, quote, have a way with bees. And I was intrigued by this idea and started doing some research. And I found the idea of what's called telling the bees. It's a Celtic tradition that goes back centuries that dictates that anyone who has bees needs to keep them up to date with family news, with anything major that happens in the family, especially a death. That's the most important one. And if the beekeeper himself or herself passes away, you have to get your new beekeeper. They go down to the hives, knock three times on the roof of the hives, and inform the bees that the keeper has died, but not to worry because a new keeper is taking care of them and they will still be cared for and provided for. And that's part of telling the bees. You can also tell them about marriages, births, other major family events. But it is important to keep that connection between the family and the bees in order for the beehives to thrive. And I got really interested in that idea and started wondering about it. And I thought, well, what would happen if when you talk to the bees, they talked back? Mm-hmm. And that's where the story came from, about bees who do talk back. So my story, it's set in the summer of 1969. It's set against the first moon landing and moonwalk for Neil Armstrong. And I use that as the backdrop because it's so hopeful and so exciting. And so many people said it was impossible for that to be done, to put men on the moon. And then also remember, you've got to get them back safely.
Right, right. And of course, there's still people who think that it's impossible and it was all faked, but
yes, absolutely. And one of my characters in the book does think it was filmed in Hollywood to fool the Russians. So I do have that in there. But my main character, Rennie, is dreaming of something she thinks is as equally unlikely, and that's just having a happy and fulfilling life. And the story is about how she and these bees that belong to her aunt, who some people thought of as a witch, but other people knew as a healer, and her uncle Dixon, help her to not just realize her dreams. I thought her dreams were not big enough. I wanted bigger things for her. And so I wrote the book about her finding not only that happy and peaceful life, but achieving what she thought would be impossible.
So this is set outside Nashville.
Yes.
Which is, and you live outside Nashville. So
I do.
Is it set in a real town?
Oh, no. I made it up because I didn't want anyone correcting me with it saying, oh, well, the bank is on the southwest corner and you said it was on the southeast corner. I thought, well, if I create my own world, nobody can tell me I'm wrong. I just have to keep straight what I've written. So sometimes I do have to go back and see, now, where did I put the bank?
And so this is...
it's made up.
It's in a little town called Spark.
Yes.
Why that name?
Because I had the spark of an idea with the Empress of Cook County. My first book is also set in that same little town. And it was just the spark of an idea to take a mother and daughter who were complete opposites and have each of them be true to their own nature. And what would happen when you put, it's like the opposite sides of a magnet, how they push away from each other. And it was just the spark of an idea. And that's where the name came from.
So are there any crossover of characters between the two novels?
Oh, yes. I took minor characters from The Empress of Cook County and made them the primary characters of Bees in June.
Okay.
So The Empress of Cook County takes place in 1966. And I like to anchor my historical fiction to something real. And I chose the Beatles' August 1966 concert in Memphis as my anchor. And that's the goal of the daughter, the younger protagonist. Her goal is to get to that Beatles concert because she's as big of a fan as I am. So that's 1966. And then I took minor characters from that book and went forward in time 3 years to 1969 and wrote Bees in June.
Well, I'm a little bit older than you, which means that for us, the Beatles were, by the time we were really aware of rock music, the Beatles had already disbanded.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which saddens me deeply, although I will say I'm going to be seeing Paul McCartney next month in concert. So I'm very excited. See, I take the long road.
I saw Paul McCartney a few years ago at the ACL Festival in Austin, And it was fabulous. Yeah.
Oh, I can't wait. Yeah. I'm really looking forward to it. But I let my character, Callie Jane, do something that I could only dream of, which is seeing all four live in concert. So that was the real event that I used and had fun putting in Beatle references into the book. Actually, my editor made me take out a few. She's like, we need to calm down on all the Beatles stuff, but I had fun including them.
Oh, so with the Bees in June, you have Rennie, and she's dealing with it. It's sort of almost like very almost standard Southern fiction in a way, in some of the things that she's dealing with, and also with the bees. The talking bees, there's a little bit of magical realism, which is also very common, I think, in Southern fiction.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about, like, your background with Southern writers. Like we talked about Fanny Flagg and your teacher. Are there others that you have really, that are sort of... would you say heroes or people that you've read a lot and look up to?
Oh, well, there are. I mean, the Southern writers, they sort of, I don't know, I connect with them, I think. And I'm not really sure why. I think it's because these people write about my people, and I understand. Whether it's an older book that, like I'm thinking of sort of a Eudora Welty or someone who wrote decades ago, it's that Southern through line of these people and how they think and how they act and how they interact with each other, I think has just fascinated me. And so I enjoy the classics, but I also enjoy... some of the new to me authors like Kimberly Brock. I've recently discovered her. She and I are with the same imprint, and finding her voice and the way she writes about Georgia is just so beautiful. And so I'm learning, I'm finding new Southern authors all the time to appreciate.
I know the one you were thinking of whose name I had to Google it too, is Flannery O'Connor. Is that who you
think? Thank you.
Yeah.
Because I was saying the life you save may be your own. That one is just, she was perfection. Absolutely. But yes, I couldn't think of the name.
I know. And I believe she attended the University of Iowa's Writers Workshop. And
yes.
Yeah. And I was not familiar with her until I was an adult. And she should be something that kids grow up knowing her writing, because it is amazing. It really is. I need to go back and reread some of that. So what is it that, other than the setting, that makes something Southern literature, Southern writing? It just seems like there is something, but I don't know that I can define it.
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure I can define it either. It's sort of a I know it when I see it kind of thing.
Exactly, exactly.
There's a little bit of irreverence, at least in my writing. The humor, Southern humor, is a lot of fun, and I do enjoy including that in my books as well. But I think there's an acknowledgement of how peculiar people can be, that we all have in our families that one relative who will just have no filter and will say whatever is on their mind and will just blurt out, often it's the truth, but maybe you're not supposed to say it in the middle of Thanksgiving dinner or whatever. But I think it's the we have a long history of colorful characters is maybe how my mom would put it.
That's a good way to put it, I think. Yeah. So why don't you read a little bit from Bees in June for us?
Okay. The passage I chose is from near the beginning of the book. Rennie has been on her porch. She's suffered a terrible loss. Her infant son has died, and she is in a deep depression, understandably so. When a bee comes to her, glowing like a lightning bug, and needs Rennie's help, and somehow she understands that she needs to go with this bee. And she does, and she finds her Uncle Dixon, who is a retired beekeeper, in a heap by the beehives. And so she's pulled him up from the ground. They're seated on a bench, and her uncle is saying something about he needs to tell the bees something. So that's where I've chosen to start. Can you tell me again why you needed to come to the hives today? I must tell them something. Our survival depends on it. Growing up, she had made a game of talking to the bees, and they had answered her in her head, like when she spoke to her dolls. A vivid imagination is what her mother said about her, using a tone that indicated this attribute was not a blessing. She had listened to her uncle speaking to his bees hundreds of times, but now he was saying the conversations were life and death. This had to be a concussion, or maybe even another stroke. She needed to call Doc Grisham. Let's head up to the house. You'll be more comfortable there. No. He pointed with a shaky finger towards the beehives. They've got to know I'm already late in telling them. He looked at Rennie and then back towards the three hives, bustling with activity. When someone dies or there's a big change in the family, you need to tell your bees right away. If you don't keep them up to date with all the goings on, they get sickly and die. Then your crops are poor, you got no honey, and everything goes sour. Listen to the buzz. That might as well be our heartbeat. The bees and us, we're connected. He shifted on the bench. I've told them three times about you. The day you were born, when you married Luther and then left that same night for him to be a baseball player up north, and then losing your boy. Her uncle had regaled her with tales her whole life. Stories about the doings of the kestrels and vireos that flew over Cook County, how trees communicated with each other through their roots and leaves, or why the star-nosed moles and swamp rabbits around the farm were such good friends. And of course, there were lots of bee stories, like the way they would push any bee from the hive who had gotten drunk on fermented fruit, or how they could warn each other of the dangers from a predator. One of her favorites was a story about how a brave little bee had saved her whole hive from one of its worst enemies, yellow jackets. But this wasn't one of his lighthearted yarns that had anywhere from a dash to a full helping of truth. What he was telling her made no sense. Wouldn't you feel better lying down in your bedroom? I could let Doc Grisham know about your fall. No, this needs to get done. His voice shook a bit as he spoke. Eugenia taught me the rules. Tell them everything, whether joy or sorrow. Say the truth the best way you know how. Squaring his shoulders, he continued, it about killed me to come down here and tell them about her passing, but I had to do it. Uncle Dixon's eyes filled with tears. The day Eugenia died, I brought down three little pieces of black fabric and tacked one to each roof to let them mourn like any other member of the family. His hand wobbled as he pointed. Step over there and feel of that first roof on the left. Rennie rose and stood before the hive, running her hand across the roof until she brushed a little nail surrounded by a tattered scrap of cloth, bleached out from 15 years in the sun. Her heart twisted at the thought of her uncle coming down here with his black fabric, hammer, and nails. Would you knock three times on each roof for me? After doing as he asked, she nodded to her uncle. He cleared his throat and in a thready voice said, okay, bees, here's some news. I've had a stroke, which means I'm not strong enough to care for you. A good man named Ambrose Beckett will be taking over for me. He was raised up around bees and knows the old ways. He's got hives of his own brought to Spark when he moved here from Kentucky. His voice shook. You'll be well tended to. Dixon rubbed his hands along his thighs. It's best to tell them before the sun has set and risen, but as long as they've been told as soon as I could get to them, that should be okay. He looked over the bee yard. This way, everything will go as it should. You know a lot about bees, and I would have asked you to tend them, but you're still healing from Gabriel. I hope you'll understand about me asking Ambrose and not you to care for him. Rennie nodded. I can still check on him, right? Absolutely.
A look Rennie could not recognize crossed his face. They know you love them, and they know you love me. I think they'd be hurt if you didn't look in on them. He nodded to the closest hive. See how they're on the landing board? Rennie glanced at the slanted piece of wood at the hive's entrance, what Rennie had always thought of as a kind of welcome mat. They're taking in the information so they can dance for any of them that was away from the hive for the announcement. He peered into her face. Have I told you why bees dance? She'd heard several versions of how bees dance to communicate everything from a warning about a new wasp nest in the area to how a load of nectar had come in and everybody needed to get to work, but she never missed a chance to hear her uncle's latest spin on one of his favorite tales. Tell me about it. Bees know what helps one bee also benefits the whole hive. When a bee finds good flowers, like a big patch of asters or yarrow, she dances out a map. The other bees watch and learn how far they need to fly, which direction to go, and about any dangers like hornets from the information that bee is dancing out to them. That's a lot to get out in a dance. And no bee ever wants to sting you. If she does, she'll die. A bee has to believe it's worth giving up her life to harm you. Rennie's mind flashed back to the bee that was so insistent about getting her attention, the one that stung Tiny when he said she couldn't take the truck to check on her uncle. The bee had fallen to the ground dead. Bees are some of God's best work, and a bee in June is best of all. A swarm of bees in June is worth a silver spoon, like the poem says. He studied the hives nestled under the trees. Watch a bee, and she'll show you what's right and how we should go. Treasure every bee you see, Rennie. I will. He looked up and pointed to the maple. It's fixing to rain. We better get on back. Rennie scanned the clear sky. How do you know that? Uncle Dixon nodded to the branches of a tree. The maples show in her petticoats. When the wind blows so you can see the underside of the leaves, you know rain's coming.
And that's Elizabeth Bass-Parman reading from Bees in June. Did you know much about bees before you started writing this?
I did not. And I was fascinated to learn so much about them. It was tempting to put more information than I did in the book, but I didn't want to overload the book. So I just saved what I thought was just the most amazing facts to include.
Well, one of them was how much honey a single bee makes.
Yes.
Which is?
1/12 of a teaspoon of honey in her lifespan. And you think about scooping out a big spoonful of honey to put on your toast or English muffin or whatever, and think about how much work that is for the bees. And it makes you think, or made me think differently about the work the bees do and how much we take for granted.
What is the lifespan of a bee, of a honey bee?
Well, it depends on when they're born. If they're born in the summer, it's about, I believe it's 12 to 18 months, but a winter bee will not live as long. And they function differently in the winter. Their primary focus is keeping each other warm so they don't freeze to death. Mm. But it's not a long life, but it is the life they are given. And how they choose to use it, and how we are the benefit as we are with so many things that bees do.
You don't talk in this book. You don't really focus on the queen bee at all, and it seems like a lot of maybe stories about bees do have some focus on the queen bee. Was that a deliberate decision?
Yes, because I have a different kind of queen bee in the story. The character of Eugenia, she's from the Appalachian Mountains in Kentucky, and she is the one who found the bees and brought them to her home when she was a child. And I include that story. There's flashbacks in Eugenia's POV, and I include that story. And I saw Eugenia as the queen bee. Mm. And then, so there can't be two queens, or if there are, one of the queens either is killed, I'm sorry to say, or she leaves and starts a different hive. But you can't have two queens in the same hive. And so if I were talking about an actual queen bee, then it would be hard to include Eugenia. So that's why I only talked about the non-queen bee.
All right. The other thing that was interesting was the whole concept of beekeepers using smoke.
Yes.
You want to explain that a little bit and why Dixon did not use smoke with his hives?
A lot of beekeepers smoke the hives if they're getting ready to open the hives or do something with the honey. And I've read different things about it, that either the smoke calms them, or which I think, well, maybe that's true, maybe it's not, or it confuses them. And it also masks the smell of the scent of danger that they're able to put out to other bees. And Dixon doesn't believe in any of that. He has a level of understanding with the bees, and he says that the smoke is just for show, and it's of no benefit. And his relationship with the bees means that he does not have to do anything artificial or to interfere with the bees' regular goings on, that they would allow him to tend their hives.
And he doesn't have to, like, cover himself either?
No, not at all. And a lot of beekeepers don't. You see that traditional suit with the hat and the netting and all of that, but not every beekeeper uses a suit. And so I chose not to include them. Although I will say, when I was researching and went to visit some hives, I was suited up because those bees didn't know me. We had no relationship.
So what did you actually do for research? And you said you went and visited hives. Did you, like, open a hive and you looked inside?
And looked at, with help. I had a beekeeper helping me. And I just wanted to see a touch the hives and smell what it smelled like, listen to it. I just wanted to be immersed in that world for a little while. So I visited the hives. I also attended a couple of meetings of the Nashville Area Beekeepers Association. I asked permission to listen in to some of their meetings, and they were very gracious and allowed me to do that. And then, of course, read so much about bees.
So, Elizabeth, did you start writing Bees in June after you had sold your first book?
Yes. I wrote the current version of it.
When
I had queried Bees in June, I was told it was a beautiful book, but it would never sell. That it was too sweet, and sweet books were not marketable.
And they're probably right.
Well, I don't know. I'm hearing that people need sweet books. I disagreed with that. But if you keep hearing it over and over again, you're like, oh, man, okay. I even had one agent, when she rejected me, she said, I love this story. It's beautiful and sweet and poignant. She said, it will get published, but I'm not going to help you.
Aww.
And she said, but when it does get published, please send me an autographed copy of it.
And did you?
I did not. She can go to her local independent bookstore and buy one for herself.
Or bookshop.org if you want to buy online. Yes, that's a way to support your local independent bookstore.
Exactly. So everyone said it was too sweet. And so that's why it went into the drawer. And I thought, okay, I'll write a book that's not so sweet. And I wrote The Empress of Cook County, that has a little bit of gothic in it, that is not a sweet story. And and that's the one that got me the agent and the auction. But then when it turned into a two-book deal, I thought, okay, I'm going to pull out my sweet story, revise it, so that it works as a second in the series, not a sequel, and it's a standalone, but that it would flow from what I had already created in The Empress of Cook County.
And there's some pretty unsweet parts to it.
Yes. Yes, there are. In Bees in June. And I do want to mention there are two content warnings. There's infant loss. Rennie, the story begins with a few weeks after Rennie has lost her only child. Her son was born prematurely. And her husband, whose name is Luther, but he goes by the nickname Tiny because he's this big huge
guy.
Big guy. But has that tiny lizard brain. That's where that came from. That he, as his life is sort of on a downward spiral, he becomes more physically abusive toward Rennie. So I do want to include those content warnings. So it's not all sweet, and it does include hard parts of life. Rennie's life, I think, is pretty hard. But who has a life that does not have hard parts? I've never met anyone who has not suffered.
You know, it almost seems like if you're born into a circumstance, into too easy a circumstance, you will create hardship for yourself.
It might be a lesson that we are here to learn.
Yeah.
That's a theory, and I think that would be right.
It is a theory, you know, because you hear about, you know, kids who were, you know, who had everything given to them and then they become drug addicts or something. So they're creating their own hardship because I don't think it's interesting enough. It's sort of like a book being can't be all sweet. There has to be some conflict, something that you're overcoming. I think life is like that too. If it's too easy, we get bored.
Well, exactly. Exactly. I do have one character, Rennie's cousin, Maydeen, and her world is perfect. Her life is perfect. And she knows that. Everybody knows that. But she could never be a main character. She's only able to be a side character. And she's my favorite because she is not very bright in the classical sense. For example, when the moon landing took place, it was a crescent moon. And she's all upset about that. And she wanted the astronauts to wait until a full moon to give them a better chance to land safely because they'd have more surface area. So,
and nobody corrected her when she said that.
Well, she said it among loved ones, and they were used to that. But, but she's smart in a different way. She understands people. And she is a good and loyal friend to Rennie. So I am thankful for her, but she's not all that smart. But her world is perfect. And I talk about Rennie comparing the difference between her own life and her cousin Maydeen's life and how they are as far apart as they could be because Rennie's life is difficult. And when I was choosing what to burden her with, because your main character does need to have struggles and burdens, thinking about a lot of women were defined or were viewed through a lens of you're a wife, you're a mother, and maybe you'll be a nurse or a teacher, but your main role is wife and mother. And I'm not agreeing with that. I'm just saying that is a prevalent thought in the 60s. And so I took both of those things away from her. I took her child away, which I hated to do, but I did. And I gave her a very dysfunctional marriage so that she had no anchor. She had nothing she could go back to. And I pretty much forced her into changing because she had nothing she could rely on.
That was one of the things that was so gripping about the book and also, you know, brought me to tears almost was this, because I know how real it was, that women who were abused were basically told it's your own fault. You made him mad. You did something you shouldn't have done. You made him mad. Go home, make up for it by people in authority. I have a dear friend of the family who was in that situation where, you know, everyone in her life was telling her just, it's your fault, put up with it. But she didn't. She left and, you know, and found a good man. And,
Excellent.
And that would have been, you know, around that time. It would have been in the 60s. And it's not that long ago.
It's not. I still remember how my mother's role was defined in, as I was growing up, watching her in social situations. I was so intrigued with it. She is a very smart woman. She went to Sweetbriar College and then Radcliffe for her graduate work. She was a working mom at first, but then by the time the third child, I mean, she was a stay-at-home mom, but she, like on the phone, she would call up and say, this is Mrs. Neil Bass, and like calling a service person to come fix the fridge or whatever. And I remember asking her, why are you using daddy's name instead of your own? And she said, oh, that's just what people do. It's to get more credibility behind the reason for your call. And I remember going to Sears with her to buy an appliance, and she was going to get a credit card. And the man said, oh, well, we'll need your husband to come in and sign for that. You can't do it. And I mean, my mom can't buy a stove.
I
mean,
I had the same experience myself as a young, young married woman in the 70s.
Yeah.
You know, where, well, does your husband know you're doing this? Does your, you know, it's like, no, and he doesn't need to.
Well, exactly. I mean, I wouldn't put up with that for a minute, but that's because of all the women behind me who paved the path for as much equality as I have now. And I saw that growing up while my mom and dad were telling me and my sisters, you can be anything you want to be, but then mom can't buy an appliance at Sears. You know, that didn't seem right to me. Yeah. And so I have some of that, I use that tension in the story of what a person should be able to do as a person, and then the social restrictions that said, oh, no, you can't do that.
It was, and women were so restricted in the 60s, even into the 70s.
Yes.
They were so restricted, and we sometimes, I think, forget. We don't want to remember what it was like. And there are people today trying to push that whole trad wife thing. You know, they don't know. They must not really understand what it was like and how hard it was for most women.
It was very hard. I mean, and I, through my child's eyes, what I saw going on. And then, of course, when I was researching my first book, set in 1966, I talked to my mom a lot about her experiences as a wife and mother, and also as a working woman, and what that was like and how hard it was. And it was humbling to realize how hard she had to work just to be doing what she wanted to do in the world, and how she was stymied at different turns, and how she would have to play the game of, like, this is Mrs. Neil Bass instead of using her own name. I mean, is that her name, or is she just dropping my dad's name? I mean, it wasn't like he was famous or anything. It was just, you're identifying yourself as a wife and therefore, you know, able to make this call to for whatever service you know that you needed.
Yeah. We really have come a long way. And whenever there's always pushback, unfortunately, but we have to remember, we don't want to get pushed back into those restricted little holes.
Oh, no. And that's, I had a lot of fun including the character of Arden in this book.
Yes.
Who, yes, she's not putting up with anything from anybody. And she's a great role model for Rennie. She owns the Blue Plate Diner in town, and she hires Rennie on as a replacement for her cook, who's had to leave to go take care of her mother. So Rennie is getting to do what she loves best, which is cooking and nurturing people through food. And she's also in the presence of a strong and independent woman who has more in common with Rennie than she realizes. As Arden tells bits and pieces of her own life story, Rennie realizes that she and Arden have a couple of things in common. And Rennie can see herself as an independent, self-sufficient woman by watching Arden and making a plan to do something similar.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Elizabeth Bass Parman, author of Bees in June. Now, Elizabeth, you mentioned that anyone can go to their independent bookstore and to get your book, and Nashville has a very famous independent bookstore, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, we do. We're very proud of it. We have Parnassus Books.
And that was
by Ann Patchett.
Ann Patchett. So that's sort of kind of a dream, isn't it, as an author, to have your own bookstore?
Yes, I think so. I mean, books have always been such a huge part of my life, and to have it as also your career would be amazing. And I sort of did that with my teaching. I taught for 30 years. I worked with reading children and adults with reading-based learning disabilities. So I was helping children to become more fluent readers. And so in a way, I was adjacent to the book world in helping these children figure out that, yes, they can read, and helping them to do that. And so that's the way that I chose to be book adjacent in
my regular career.
But I mean, wow, what a dream to find such a beautiful and supportive and famous bookshop.
Absolutely. So Elizabeth, let's talk a little bit about your writing process. Are you someone who plots things out before you start writing, or do you discover what's going to happen as you go?
I will plot out the main points of the story, the beats of the story, and I write it out in outline form. But I like to, where I know the major points, and I always know where I'm going to begin, and I always know where I'm going to end. And I know so that I know the big things that happen along the way. But the magic for me comes when I have a blank spot in my outline where I just have chapter 7 or whatever, and it's blank. And the fun of, you know, you've set up your inciting incident and the beginning story, and off you go, and you know exactly what that is because you've been thinking about it for weeks or even months. But then you're like, okay, now before this other plot point happens, what's going to happen now? What is chapter 7 going to be about? Because it's not on my outline. And that's the discovery part of it that I really enjoy.
Oh, wow. Now, another sort of important element in Bees in June, which seems to me to be a fairly common part of Southern writing, is food.
Oh, yes. Food.
Yes. So Rennie is a fabulous baker.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about some of her specialties.
Well, Rennie had a difficult childhood. Her parents both worked, and they really didn't have time for her. And that's why she was raised primarily by her Uncle Dixon and her Aunt Eugenia. But she would go to the kitchen as an escape. And she, at first, she loved just being told what to do via the recipes. Add this, stir that, you know, mix in this piece, and then cook it for this long at this temperature. She was given step by step instructions, which she kind of needed to navigate her own life. But then as she became more comfortable and more familiar with it, she found the artistry of it, where she could express herself through the food, that she could try a twist on a recipe, or what would happen if I added this instead of that. And her experimentation and her creativity was expressed through the food that she prepared. And on a very basic level, she fed people. You have to eat every day. And so she was providing a necessity that her farmhand husband needed, and that any person would need to eat. But then it became more than that, and it became a way to show love and to express her creativity. And she doesn't really connect with that until she needs to get some information. There's a stranger has come to town, and she's very suspicious of him. He's a sort of the tall, dark, and handsome type, but his background is very mysterious, and she suspects his motives are different from what he's claiming. And she's like, how can I get through to him? And she goes into the kitchen and bakes a cherry pie to take to him to introduce herself to the new neighbor in town. But she says, let's try to channel the George Washington, I cannot tell a lie, idea. Uses a cherry pie to see if she can get some information out of this handsome stranger, Ambrose Beckett, who's moved to town.
Now, she becomes very well known for her honey cake. Now, baking with honey can be a little tricky.
Yes.
Did you actually make this cake?
I did. I made several versions of it, and they turned out pretty well. I am not an awesome baker. I wish I were. Maybe I keep giving my characters abilities and experiences that I myself cannot have. And I'm not an awesome baker, but Rennie is. But I did cook with honey to see what it was like, because I have to experience it. I can't just imagine what something would be like. I want to get in the kitchen and pull those same ingredients out and try. And so I did create a version of the honey cake. And it turned out pretty well.
Oh, well, Elizabeth, we're out of time today, and I want to thank you for being with us on Writers' Voices. I always close with a quote, and I found this one, which I think is pretty apt, from James Russell Lowell. Books are the bees which carry the quickening pollen from one to another mind.
Oh, I love that. I hadn't heard about that one, but that's beautiful.
Well, thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.